Checking in again with State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy for another Tacky Talk. Good morning, Tacky.
Good morning, Joe. Happy to be here another week spending time together.
I think it's been, I'll have to go back and check how many of these we've actually done, but I know it's been over 2 years now.
I know, I expected an anniversary gift at some point.
Oh, wow. Okay. Now the pressure's on. Have to see what I can come up with. Maybe a new decoration for the back of your wall there.
I am not compensated to appear on this show, just to let everybody know.
That's a good point, actually. Yes, nobody is. This is true true local access here, where we're unhinged and unplugged. But the state legislature is still actually probably one of the busiest times of the year, right before you come to the end at the end of July.
Yeah, as I say, we're counting down the days, right? We're down to 17 days. Today's the 14th. We're down to 17 days to the 31st of July, which is a Sunday. Talk to my colleagues, and we're all getting ready for a weekend run, for lack of a better term. Whether it be a continuation remote, or we're going to pop into the building, or some combination, depending what the status of each member is. But no, we're getting ready for a midnight run. We did actually a midnight run in a strange way in 2021, just prior to the start of the new swearing-in day. And, you know, with Speaker Mariano became Speaker, you know, 7 or so days remaining in session, it became a 2-day nonstop deep into the night. As House and Senate chairs and House and Senate leaderships are trying to negotiate the final versions of bills we're trying to send to the governor. So the end of session is actually very important, because the governor has the ability to veto bills. And if we're not present to override a bill, then the governor's veto stands. This also applies to line item vetoes, as well as potentially amendments are a little different. People don't realize the governor can amend bills and send them back. The legislature can re-amend a bill, or accept the amended bill, or reject the amended bill, and, you know, not make it go any further, or make it move again to go back to the governor. But the governor can, again, veto a bill after amending, and then we can, you know, play with the amendment, so to speak, and negotiate with the governor at that stage. Well, so there's a lot of tools in the governor's pocketbook towards the end of this cycle. Pocketbook, more like, you know, those long wallets. Pull it like some kind of magic play cards. But I mean, he has a lot of, you know, options here as we close the session. And even though we're under emergency rules, Speaker made it very clear that he has no interest on continuing the session past July 31st, pending some kind of amazing level crisis. And right now, COVID seems somewhat manageable, despite we all know more people getting it than ever. And the numbers are ticking up. But I mean, you know, we feel that it's, we shouldn't need to come in unless there's major crisis, because last time out, we were really running a nonstop session through 2020, constantly on call, potentially needing to come in to pass any law that would address the pandemic.
I'm glad you brought up the whole veto concern, Tacky. And I know we didn't plan to talk about this, but I know you're well-versed and able to talk about the climate justice bill. And you know, as you know, there was a rally here in Quincy, and there's rallies across the state earlier this week. What is the climate justice bill?
Well, it's really the winning climate bills, kind of. That's what the bill is. It's winning climate. So there's a bill in conference committee, of which I'm sitting on the conference committee, that would provide more large wind development purchases from the state under certain conditions. It would create some workforce training opportunities regarding new technologies, especially these new windmills, of which the intention is the state would like to have these things assembled and constructed, at least assembled minimum, in Massachusetts, and then in the future hopefully have construction. And to also fund the Clean Energy, the Clean Energy Council, the CEC, which does a lot of projects on like windmill structural testing and other testing new technologies out to see the viability of future clean energy. As you may be aware, a lot of people have a lot of prototypes, but a lot of prototypes don't always work at a large scale. You build a small model, it seems to work, but once you try to generate up to a large model technology for our large energy consumption, it doesn't work that well. I mean, it's I see a lot of small things, and it's like, okay, what happens if we make it, I don't know, a million times bigger, you know, it's a whole different, it doesn't scale one-to-one. So we also have stuff in there regarding marine fisheries in particular. There's a lot of concern about what the impact is on windmill construction on maritime life, especially fish and lobsters. You know, for example, you got a trench, lobsters like to crawl along the bottom. Trenches are a problem. They have to swim around, maybe go somewhere else, or potentially maybe water temperature changes. We've never had this type of windmill development on offshore windmill development that is within, you know, the currents, the major currents of the oceans coming in from the north, the Gulf Coast currents, right? You know, for those of you who took science class, remember during the winter months, the Gulf Coast actually goes further out to sea. And, you know, when the summer months go, the current comes closer to land, and it has huge effect on our temperatures, but also most importantly, it affects marine life because marine life follows the currents. So, you know, the other major large windmill projects, you know, either very few of them will end up in places like the Black Sea, which, you know, it's cold and weathery and kind of like crappy weather up there. So it's a little bit of a different scenario. And we believe that, you know, a study and a lot of monitoring of the impact of coastal wildlife is important for the fishery and lobster industry. And see what, you know, get some real life impacts of what will happen.
Okay.
So, I mean, there's a lot of other stuff in there regarding electric cars, charging stations that the Senate proposed, building code changes the Senate proposed. So we're working our way through this on so many different issues that are not wind related.
But so the, still in committee though?
Still in conference committee. We met this week. I can't get into the details of what we said. However, you know, it was a good conversation for folks to lay out a bit more about, you know, what the priorities in each branch is.
Okay.
See if we can work on a compromise, or maybe we'll be stuck on certain issues, and hopefully we get to agree, disagree, and move on to the next issue we can agree upon. But these are small rooms. I mean, there's only six of us in this conference committee, and, you know, it makes it a little easier because you're not, like, you know, the bigger the room, the harder it is to get consensus. But again, we're also carrying the interests of our various representatives and senators going to the room as well. Obviously, you know, I represent a coastal community, but I don't have a huge maritime economy. I'm aware we have floundermen and we have lobstermen and such. But you know, we feel like from Gloucester, for example, you know, which is fishing and lobstering is still a major part of their economy in large scale. You know, the impact of large wind, you know, is different from some communities have smaller amounts of maritime economy.
Yeah. So, okay. So, but the supporters' concerns that the governor would veto something are really only if it gets reported out of committee. Is that right?
Well, we have the same concern, obviously, because the time is working against us. We are aware the governor's office is very interested in the windmill project. That part, the three of us agree on, the three branches being the Senate, the House, and the governor agree upon that. And, you know, there's some, you know, conversations about what does the other stuff mean? And is the other stuff a deal breaker for the governor because it was never part of the governor's priorities?
Oh, okay.
So as we inch closer to the time frame where we may not be able to override a veto or have troubles amending the bill, you could potentially put a big wind at risk. And the governor himself is not running for re-election.
Right.
So from his standpoint, whatever.
I mean, so if it just stays in committee, then it stays in committee.
Yes, I am still anticipating that the committee will work out some kind of a compromise at some point. I just don't have I can't give you a definitive time.
Yeah, okay.
It's not for lack of trying here.
Okay, yeah, I know the speaker himself is very interested in expanding wind energy. I think he mentioned the South Coast as a possibility for development.
Yeah, we've already put $100 million of ARPA money into the South Coast to prepare for the future of wind development. You know, for those of you guys that, you know, from that area, you know, are aware of, you know, large deep water port access, you know, old industrial complexes right on the water, acres and acres of land that would be closest to the large wind projects, you know, down in the South Coast. And the hope is that, you know, if there's sufficient expansion of that, perhaps, you know, other old industrial ports that have sufficient acreage, you know, could be also supportive of windmill parts assembly or windmill parts construction in the long run. So this is a really a long-term picture, most likely beyond my time in politics. Because like you said, putting 300 feet of steel in the ground in a moving ocean isn't exactly as easy as it sounds.
Right,
laying down all this underground cable because you don't want cable exposed too much. And then you also have to, you know, bring these blades over from Europe because we don't have the capacity to build these monster blades yet, but at least put them together here. And then, you know, down the road, hopefully perhaps we'll, you know, as windmill parts need to be replaced, you know, maybe it's more practical and cost-effective to do them in Massachusetts.
Right. Well, we still have the Quincy Shipyard.
Well, Danny Quirk may be looking at a development change down the road. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we all know there's a lot of industrial land and water and many old shipbuilding or cargo or whatever, past economies. And also possibly for some old mill cities that have good railroad track access, perhaps, that still has some old industrial capacity that may be good, especially this conversation with the South Coast Rail. But we already have various cargo capacities, you know, to various areas along the old lines, too. So maybe even before you do commuter rail, you have more cargo rail. At least there's a lot of potential here. I'm not saying any things are going to happen. This is definitely like a 10 to 20 year economic development plan revolving around clean energy. But I mean, some of it's already going to happen. I think people also don't realize that we already have bids in for wind now. So this purchasing for more big wind and setting conditions to purchase this big wind is good, but we already got bids in now that's been accepted. So,
okay, so it's already started.
I mean, I think this is incorrect impression that this is our first go at this. It's not. We've been buying renewable power, you know, back, you know, 20 years ago. And then, you know, about 12 years ago, we ramped it up to a next level of increasing up power purchases from our utilities for renewable. And even more so, again, about 8 years ago, we implemented the idea of big wind and purchasing big wind. And, you know, we went forward and, you know, to big wind offshore specifically, because if they don't have customers, they won't build. So now let's make this clear, folks. There is already big wind purchases in play now under prior bills. We're looking to expand to have more big wind purchases through this bill that's in conference.
Okay, very good. Speaking of economic development, Jackie, do you want to give me $250?
That is exactly what I'm going to be doing.
Thank you.
Not exactly in the handout, in terms of handout to you personally. I mean, it would be wonderful if I could physically just walk through the door and give you a check. But obviously, I don't think the state comptroller would like the idea of printing checks.
Oh, they probably frown on that, yeah.
Yeah, here's a bunch of envelopes, Representative. Go ahead and go door to door with these.
Let's talk about this, the economic development bill, actually, right?
Yeah, as you're all aware, I mean, the governor had proposed about $700 million of permanent tax breaks, including one that really was frowned upon on capital gains changes. Short-term capital gains is charged at a higher rate, I believe 12% versus the 5%. That is your income taxes. We are a flat tax state. And I also remind folks, you actually have a chance to change being a flat tax state this November on the so-called Fair Share Amendment to the Constitution to create a plus 4% tax rate above the 5 for individuals making $1 million plus one. So that's in your hands this November. You guys can decide if that's a good or bad idea. That being said, I mean, we are implementing a few tax things through the economic development bill that we are talking about. As everybody now knows, you know, $510 million of surplus funds would be used to give $23 to people who made over $30,000 to $100,000 as a single filer and up to $150,000 as a joint filer, $500. A lot of people on the call may be aware that $500 checks for people making less than $30,000 did go out earlier this year, and that represents about $500 million of ARPA money for people who work in the pandemic. And a lot of folks in the lower income wage did work in the pandemic. We've all seen them ourselves, particularly, you know, folks that are in the cleaning services, people who are working hospital on the low wage, assisted living on low wage, as well as the folks that keep us fed, stocking shelves in supermarkets. So I always like to remind folks that I'm very grateful for healthcare and public safety, but I'm also very grateful for, you know, folks that do the backbreaking work to make sure that I can eat. You know, it's very important. I always thank people who provide us those services. It's not appreciated enough sometimes.
Yes, everything from truck drivers to stock clerks are vitally important to keep that moving. Sure.
Yeah. Very. You know, the folks that help keep us fed and make sure that our medications are ready, right, when we go to the pharmacy. So you know, the feeling of the legislature is that, you know, a lot of folks, you know, could use some assistance given the current times, especially with inflation being so high. And a one-time payment of $250 or $500, depending on your tax filing, you know, made some sense. And it's a one-time, which is very important, because when you talk about tax changes, unless you sunset them, they all tend to be forever. So when we do our calculations for tax changes, we need to think about this in a multi-fiscal year format, knowing that the economy does not always grow at the same pace, which affects our revenues, right? And you've heard me talk before about capital gains potentially taking a massive dive because the market is not good. Home sales are slowed, but then again, we have a stock problem. We don't have a lot of homes to sell anymore. Massive buying last year has resulted in a lack of stock of homes. And, you know, of course, consumer spending will keep changing. Consumers spend differently now, as well as I'm sure everyone watching, to try to make ends meet, facing the same economic pressures like everyone else. So the feeling is that, you know, hey, I mean, this is a little bit of assistance, you know, $250 to try to help everyone out. And it's a one-time payment that we can actually afford to do. So the other stuff that are permanent will also cost us about $500 million. That will be $500 million plus a revenue loss for us down the road. We increased the housing tax deduction for renters. I believe we went from $3,000 to $4,000 on that. Again, a little bit of help come April tax day to increase that deduction for folks. We increased the earned income tax credit from 30% to 40% of the federal allowance. We've raised this kind of gradually over the last decade. You know, will impact a lot of folks at the low end of socioeconomics more. Again, the argument you've heard in the public is that we should have given $250 to people under $30,000 in income a year. But Dale's got $500 already, it says, during the pandemic, and now we are going to expand the earned income tax credit, which also will help folks in that income bracket range if you qualify.
And those are permanent changes, right? That's not a one-time deal, yeah.
This is permanent changes. We're looking at, you know, losing, in the media term, $500 million in tax revenue through these changes. We also go and adjust the estate tax. Speaker's talked a lot about this on his road tour. When he's visiting communities about the fact that you have an exemption of the first $1 million from estate tax. However, once you go to $1,000,001, your whole estate is taxed, including that first million that's quote unquote exempt because you crossed the $1 million barrier and it's no longer exempt. So it's kind of like a cliff reference. It's like a cliff. You get to this and you drop off. Yeah. So we decide that's dumb. And we're the only state that does this. So we stop that. And we increased the state tax exemption to $2 million.
Yep.
So that you are not taxed on the first $2 million of your estate, no matter what. So you get $4 million, the first two is a tax exempt.
Yeah, which, I mean, given the state of housing in this state, it wouldn't be hard to get up to $2 million.
No, yeah, it isn't. People talk about, oh, you're only helping rich people. But, you know, even in Quincy, and you know, I think everyone should be aware of this. I mean, you look at your property taxes. I know everyone's paying is over your property taxes. So I hear that a lot, but it's tied to the value of your home. Mm-hmm. Largely is. And, you know, people's homes, you're absolutely right. It's approaching that $750 to $1 million range as housing stock becomes thinner and thinner every moment. The buyers of homes are going to keep jacking up the price because a home seller can.
Right.
And they're going to bid war going upwards, not downwards. So, you know, it's not hard if you're preparing to downsize and move on, that your property value could exceed close to $1 million. Plus, you know, God forbid, you know, you pass away or somebody, family pass away and leave you an estate behind, you know, things like insurance, you know, things like savings accounts, you know, could very quickly pass $1 million, especially, you know, sadly, unless you die in your 60s. You know, and you were very wise to have a huge nest egg to live to potentially 80 or 90. Yeah, you could find yourself, you know, like $1.5 million.
Right.
Including your property. And whoever has to take care of your estate, you know, we have to do those tax ramifications. So obviously, you know, if you have an estate planner, you know, a state attorney, you know, with these changes, it's probably a good idea to have a chat with them. About, you know, how to change your planning, because the current planning is around the fact that you could be potentially taxed on everything $1 million plus $1 million. So not to create work for estate planners, but, you know, I think it's a good idea to have a follow-up consultation with this law change.
And, absolutely, yeah, and have a discussion with your family too, so everybody knows what's going on and what the potentials are if something does happen.
Oh, absolutely. Not like we want to talk about death, but, you know, it's important to have this planning in place as you get older. And I think COVID really has stimulated people's minds on that as well. You know, we talk about the great resignations, which is now what it's called, the economic way in, is again, people are looking at, you know, their portfolios. They have boomer 2021, time to cash out and get ready for whatever stage in life they want to move to. Same thing if you're a pension employee. You know, how much worth it is to work, you know, another year for perhaps another $1,000 in pension a year, right?
Right. So,
you know, everyone's, you know, it's up to you all. I mean, everybody's got to make decisions on their own. But I mean, I truly believe, you know, that COVID has, you know, really stimulated a lot of folks who are getting close to retirement age to rethink their finances. And those of us who are going to be around a little bit longer before retirement, you know, obviously going to ride out the bad market. In your Roth IRAs or 401s, in my case, a 457, because we don't have 401 or 403, it's our 457, which, by the way, isn't as good as a 401, to be honest with you. 401 can do so much more than my 457. But I mean, you have your Roth and you have your IRAs and you have your private investments. So, you know, there's a lot of moving parts. So the estate tax, you know, I don't know, we don't want to talk about death, but, you know, it's an important part that's going to have a, you know, huge impact on folks. And on the flip side, we need to make a little money. So the estate tax on everything over $5 million will be taxed at 70%.
Okay.
So there's a bit on the flip side. And we did, through an amendment yesterday, make it a little more clearer on the estate tax table. I don't think it was clear to all of us exactly how it would work, but the estate tax tables, you know, have been adjusted again, I think. Hang on.
Oh, okay.
So it's more clear exactly how this would work.
We're getting breaking news here, folks, straight from the source.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, we'll continue to, you know, work towards, you know, more, you know, economic development pieces, you know, that, you know, also put investments, you know, in, you know, workforce education, small business development, you know, broadband expansion, hotel industry still suffering, you know, so we provide direct grants. They got some small hotels, motels got, you know, PPP type support, but the bigger hotels did not. You know, we put money in housing, affordable housing trust fund. People very supported that. We put some money directly into tourism, Office of Tourism, to continue to promote the state more heavily, especially in-state folks that come visit to us. You know, we are, tourism is our number two or number three economic driver. COVID, and still with COVID, has caused a huge detriment to that. Oh yeah, another great one, the senior circuit breaker. We've had the delegation come in to talk to Mark about the senior circuit breaker. You can look at past videos to see us. We changed the base number that from $750 to $1,755. And this takes a little bit of explanation because it's those who take advantage of the tax credit realize it's not $750. So it's $750 plus CPI. So it's been adjusted every year. And I believe this last cycle, this last tax year was $1,150. But the base number hasn't changed. Of course, the world around us has changed. So we're going to shift the base number to $1,755.
Okay.
Add over $1,000 from the original base. So starting next tax year, when you apply for your senior circuit tax credit, which again, if you're 65 by the end of this year and you meet certain property valuations, you know, you can, and you pay property taxes and, you know, water bill, which are the two things that are calculation. And if you're a renter that meets certain income guidelines as well, you can apply for the senior circuit tax credit, and credits equal cash, meaning that even if you paid no taxes, you can get money back. And I know a lot of folks that are living on Social Security do not pay taxes, and they're living on some passive income.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, if you're going to turn 65 at the end of this year, most definitely next year, fill out the senior circuit tax form to see if you qualify. It'll take about 15 to 20 minutes of your time. Very simple math. At least please, you know, I'm really asking that you all please at least fill out the form to see if you qualify.
Oh, it's a huge benefit. My mom used to benefit from that every single year as well. And is it still retroactive, Tacky? Say if you're 70 years old and you realize, oh gosh, I didn't apply for that for the past 5 years, can you still do that?
Yeah, that's very important. We have 3-year look back.
Okay.
So you have a chance to amend your taxes 3 years prior to the current tax year to get that money. And if you qualify, you can get that money.
Yeah, it's really, really, really helpful. Think about that, you know, $1,750, that's a huge chunk of change for somebody.
Yeah. And, you know, this program has been in place well into 20 plus years. Yeah. It has been great for folks, that are having, a little extra dollars to help, you know, offset your property taxes. And also please do remind your tax preparer. I've had this happen of some folks that call me, had tax prepared. Sometimes the tax preparer didn't realize that, you are 65 and older and you should try to, take a go at this.
Yeah. Yeah. Is this a unique thing to Massachusetts? Do you know?
Yeah. Every state's got different types of tax programs for different seniors qualifications, but this is actually relatively unique to us because of the fact it's actually tied directly to property tax and water bill.
That's it.
So it is literally designed to address property tax relief at some level. Because how much you pay in property taxes and water bill determines how much you qualify. Same thing on rent. How much you pay in rent, as a senior renter, is how you qualify. So, yeah, and given the high property taxes you're all paying, it's a good chance you're going to hit the maximum.
Yes, very much so. Yeah. And I mean, this might take care of a quarter of that, depending on the size of your property.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Right. And it also puts, a little bit, offsetting some of that, puts a little bit of disposable income in your pocket that you weren't expecting to see.
Yeah. Is that rebate taxable?
The rebate, the $250 or $500 rebate you may be getting, depending on your filing, is not state taxable.
Okay.
However, we are not the federal government. So those who may remember that the stimulus checks you all received, which was $500 and something, I forgot, they gave us so many stimulus checks. We're not taxable by the state nor by the federal government. So it literally was free money. This amount for the $250 and $500 one-time rebate payments, is what it's being called, it's not state taxable. However, you may have to report them on your federal income taxes. That one's out of my control. Go talk to Congressman Lynch, Senator Markey, and Senator Warren. But again, if you're not sure, consult your tax accountant. Read very carefully, the Form 1 of your IRS tax code, tax forms to make sure you get this correct.
Okay. There's always a catch.
We do the best at the level of government we can.
Right.
Fully aware that certain things are well out of my control, whether it be a municipal government issue or a federal government issue.
So. Okay, fair enough. So where does this bill stand? Do you think it's going to be passed this session?
I believe so. This governor and the Senate president and speaker have committed to do at least these tax rebates. Now, other aspects of the economic development bill you know, the Senate will have its own ideas on maybe the proposed new tax credits, maybe the proposed new tax deductions in the Senate. It's who knows what's going to happen once amendments start, right? Over the other branch. And, you know, once they do their debate, which is most likely to be sometime early or mid next week, you know, it could be conference committee very quickly, and we might miss the deadline regarding vetoes. We talked about, you know, 10 days of receipt. So whenever the governor has that bill on his desk is when the 10 days begin on the veto, not when we pass it.
Okay.
His desk. So, you know, if it arrives on July 21st on his desk, he's got 10 days, July 31st to send his vetoes. But if it applies on the 22nd of July, 10 days puts you in the first day of August. Right. So we would not be able to override vetoes. Again, the amendment thing I talked about is a little bit of a confusing process, but, you know, those things are in his options to utilize. So, yeah, I mean, this is, a, you know, for lack of a term, it's like, a, you know, a whirlwind end to the session.
And, it really is, yeah.
You know, and I can't predict how it's going to play out. I'm trying to keep up with everything myself.
Okay. All right. We'll wait and see. Maybe by this time next week when we talk, we'll have another update. There's a new COVID vaccine, Jackie.
Yeah, Novavax or Novavax. I can't remember, there's an O and A in the middle.
Novavax, yeah.
Novavax, yeah. This is actually a vaccine that's already been approved by the, I believe, the European Union.
Mm-hmm. It has been, yeah.
So it got approved first. And this is not an mRNA vaccine. I know people are very concerned about new technology. This is actually a technology that's protein-based and closer to the flu vaccine technology. The flu vaccine technology was used for the Chinese vaccine as well as the Russian vaccine, which, you know, has proven not to have the same efficacy rate, although they don't release their numbers, but a lot of the behavior in China makes us think that it's not, you know, when you're locking down 100 million people in cities, I mean, it's
something's not working. Yeah.
Not working. I mean, that's generally a clue that something's not right with your vaccine. Right. Even though it's approved in Europe, I mean, it obviously took a lot longer time for it to get emergency use now in the US. It is a US vaccine. I actually had a friend who actually was a participant in this on the trials. You know, it's been proven effective. I mean, she didn't get, you know, she had COVID exposure. Again, this is a long time ago, before Omicron, but she had COVID exposures and the vaccine was working. And it is, like I said, a traditional, more traditional vaccine. And it is protein-based, which is what the flu vaccine and all the other vaccines are based off of. So if you're concerned about mRNA, and I did take Pfizer and Moderna, in case people are wondering, I did the mix and match for the booster. You don't have another option if you've been vaccine hesitant about the technology. This one is something that you're all more used to, for lack of a better term. It's a two-shot vaccine, and it's a newer vaccine. And generally, the rule right now, it seems the newer vaccine is a little bit more effective with the variants that come out.
Right. Yeah.
Not saying it always is the case, but a little more, right? And, you know, there is an active talk to Moderna may have a Omicron-ready vaccine by, you know, this fall time. Perhaps we'll see October, November, maybe December, maybe, you know, fall into early winter. You know, the vaccine, as you know, we're seeing another wave of BA5 overtaking the other viruses, which is, again, it's more transmissible than the other versions. And there's talk about whether or not it's actually causing more severe symptoms than its previous Omicron cousins. They're trying to figure that out now as part of studying the intake of people going to hospitals and whatnot. So, you know, they're trying to figure this thing's mutating. Perhaps it's becoming slightly more dangerous.
Yeah.
So if you haven't got your third booster, please do, or your fourth booster if you're over age 50. You'll definitely get it now. The numbers are going ticking up. You want to maximize your antibodies when the numbers are ticking up.
Yeah, I wish they don't seem to publish the wastewater data as much anymore. I wish they would, because I think that'd be a truer indicator of what's going on, just because of all the home testing that's going on now.
Oh, absolutely correct. I still, and I think everyone now accepts the fact that people at home test are not reporting them to their government. The DPHs and CDC is not getting your information on your home test when you test positive. So, you know, and also, like I said before, I mean, during the high wave, kids are bringing home to their parents. And one of the other children get infected COVID, but not at the school, but really at the school. I mean, come on, people brought it home from school. I love it. The school, like, ah, he didn't come from school, because then he got it home, like, The kids were at school. Where do you think it came from?
Well, right. It's always been a germ incubator in those classrooms.
It's also like faulty logic, right? I mean, where do you think it came from? So, I mean, the school numbers don't only reflect those people infected in the school, not the people who went home and then became positive. So, like, the numbers are a mess. And not blame the home test, because the home test has been invaluable, because it's, you know, a lot of my friends who got it knew right away to keep away, right? There was no, like, wait period. Well, maybe I'm all right. No, you're positive. It's not going to your people. But at the same time, though, I really believe it was created a lot of underreporting. And the wastewater, you know, only represents about a million people in the state, but, you know, the virus, you know, is expelled from your body and, you know, shows up in the wastewater samples and gives the idea what the trend is. The other way we only can keep trends, and it's through the hospital. Hospital intake is rising. The IC rooms are now filling up, you know, a little bit at a time, but they're filling up. And that's the only way we can tell where the severity is regarding hospitalizations. There are some great websites out there that give you the seven-day average on hospitalizations, including COVID confirmed positive hospitalizations, because they're still reporting that information to CDC and DPH. So I believe there's a Minnesota newspaper that I use that I can't think of it right now, but I should email the link so you can look at it. I don't know how you give it to other people, but I'll give it to you. That is actually a great on the 7-day average, and it actually addresses every hospital in the United States.
Good for them. That's it's important information for sure. And it's not going away anytime soon, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think hospitalization rates is one of those things that really brings it home to people when they really see it. Hospital capacity over the years have not near 100% at all, because of outpatient services and, you know, a better medication, better treatments does not need as much hospital stays. Mm. But when you're seeing hospital stays at such a high rate beyond normal usage, like pre-COVID usage, you know, is an indication that, you know, this is challenging. And hospitals have changed economic models to reflect, you know, again, better outpatient services, better treatment services, lower times you have to be in the hospital. I mean, you know, there's modern technology, modern medicine has really created efficiencies in hospital systems, so they don't actually have to staff the same like they did 30 years ago. COVID has completely changed the staffing component, which again, I think you all see out there, there's a shortage of healthcare workers now as people burn out. And, you know, the workforce shortage is already a problem for everyone. But you know, there in particular, and, you know, part of economic development, we also address some of the economic shortfalls. I love the conspiracy theories here that COVID is being promulgated so hospitals can make more money. Well, approximately right now, hospitals have lost about $500 million through COVID in terms of deficit. Again, it's driven by largely, you know, getting ventilators, getting antibiotics, getting all the relevant medication that you need, you know, increase security in terms of like preventative medicine, preventive infection. It's all kinds of new security protocols or anti-infection protocols that has required more PPP and screens and all this other stuff, and also new protocols for healthcare. Workers, whether you're changing the sheets or you're a surgeon, doesn't matter. And also, you know, segregating rooms out, and also, you know, rescheduling patient services that normally you can bill insurance for. So, yeah, the hospitals are bleeding money up here.
Right. You know, I'm glad you brought up your friend who participated in the clinical trials, because those are some of the unsung heroes, I think, in this whole pandemic, is folks that, especially during the initial vaccine trials, that agreed to participate in that. I mean, think about that for a minute. They were agreeing to take part in something that had never been done before.
Yeah, absolutely. You're taking a medication that has been, you know, quite frankly, you know, fast-tracked mm-hmm. on research, and they reached human trial phase. And honestly, if you look at the studies, it's been fairly accurate regarding the side effects. And it's still not a big portion of the population had, you know, potentially very severe, potentially lethal side effects. It's a very tiny part of the population. And the clinical testing reflected a lot of that real world data we're living with. And, you know, all these symptoms like, you know, the fever and aches and Pfizer and the clinical tests, well, guess, you know, I had fever and aches, mm-hmm. you know, mostly aches than fever. But I mean, I was having chills, but the temperature didn't go up. It was kind of funny. But yeah, that was actually on the list of the impact of people in clinical trial. And, You know, it was a good number of folks that had these side effects. I think a lot of people may have felt through it. So, you know, yeah, I mean, you know, they also have to be working in a profession or living a lifestyle in which they have an increased potential of COVID exposure. One of the things that's challenging on like places like China, because of constant lockdown, is that reduced COVID exposure makes human testing much more difficult because you're not near people. How can you potentially be infected? Right. And you have to have a diverse, you know, gender, race, socioeconomic, it's got to be a broad range sampling. So, you know, and then as you see, the FDA does take their sweet time approving these things for emergency use as they review the data. You know, so yeah, I mean, a lot of these, you know, people are either taking the placebo or the actual trial vaccine and going up there and, you know, report back what happens. And the reason we know these side effects exist is because, you know, these folks are willing to submit themselves to it and report back potential side effects, which may make the manufacturer want to push it forward or maybe stop them from pushing it forward.
Right. Yeah.
There's a lot of vaccine developers up there. I mean, there's like a dozen plus. And, you know, we're at four. So.
Right. Just goes to show you how rigorous the process is, you know, to finally come out with a product that you can use in the public.
Yeah, you need to have the research and technology setting up, that the right lab and the brain power to do this. So it isn't like, you know, any pharmaceutical companies just decided to go to vaccine manufacturing. You have to be in this field.
That's right. No, I think a lot of them decided not to go down that road because of those roadblocks, the cost and everything else associated with that.
Yeah, you don't get paid until you have something.
That's right. It's all speculation. Yeah.
So the U.S. government has, you know, already bought 3 million or so vaccine doses reserved for the U.S. public. You know, the U.S. government already did that, you know, way back in the Trump administration as they prepared. And you know, they basically went to every pharmaceutical and said, you have a guarantee we'll buy your stuff, provided your stuff passes FDA approval. So you're right. Companies see the hundreds of million dollars they have to put at risk to develop vaccines. And, you know, they decide their technology and their know-how isn't sufficient to justify the cost. Some other ones, you know, believe they have the ability to do it. And they know this money ended in a rainbow, you know, in a putting it that way, you know, the money available provided that they can deliver.
Right, exactly. Why don't we end on a lighter note, Tacky?
Lighter note?
Yeah. I know it's not your belly wagon, but
no, it's not my belly wagon. I don't do lighter notes. You know, well, I mean, I don't know. Has anyone seen good pet videos, lady?
Do you have any pets, as a matter of fact?
I do not have pets. I'm not a great animal person. But I do watch this YouTube video, why not, called Mocha Milk. It's a Korean family in Canada that has this Samoan dog that is actually very adorable named Woo Woo. And has a Pomeranian named Mocha, hence Mocha Milk. And it's just 5 minutes of just kind of like amusement. And also see how other people are living through COVID in different places and the impact it has, not just on them, but also their pets. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's one of the fun things I watch on YouTube. That's kind of a mental health stress relief. If you want something a little bit lighter, I do watch other people's pets on YouTube.
We all need our outlets for sure.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, the movie theaters are back online. And capacity is still very challenged, and of course competing against streaming. But you know, it seems that, you know, getting back to the theater, some people should consider. I do, you know, do not encourage you to do what you're not comfortable, don't do it. But you know, again, I've been watching theaters during going to theaters when there's as little people as possible, as my schedule allows. And, I went and saw Doctor Strange 7 weeks after it came out. But, I did go see that. I saw Buzz Lightyear, something like, you know, another Pixar film. And obviously, I'm looking forward to my Marvel comic book movie stuff. So, you know, Thor is out and I'll probably wait another 3 weeks before I do that. Probably once after session ends, I will take advantage of some free time where I know there's less people in the theater.
Okay. We'll have to do some movie reviews. Tacky's picks.
Yeah, I tend to lean towards a bit of the lighter stuff and, you know, a bit of my enjoy my fantasy on comic book type related things. I do like some children's films, which is, you know, kind of strange, but it's a good, you know, mental health release. And
hey, Disney has made an entire fortune on that. So,
and I did miss out some movie theater ones. For example, I missed out on the new Downton Abbey film. So we'll catch up with that on streaming. Some of the stuff didn't stay in the theater long enough. And one that got a lot of critical acclaim was Michelle Yeoh's movie, Everything Everywhere at Once. That got a lot of good buzz, but you know, sad. It stayed a lot longer in the theaters because of lack of content in the theaters. This has been why theaters are having struggles, that they don't have enough new content beyond the COVID issue. People do not want to see, well, maybe you do want to see the same movie 14 times, but I mean, you know, more content that's out there. So, you know, that movie stayed out a bit longer, but didn't last as long as they thought it would compared to things like Spider-Man and Top Gun and, you know, some of these other films that, you know, have more of a blockbuster draw.
Yeah, interesting.
So, you know, it's also some smaller films, you know, are lasting a little longer. You have an ability to probably see that. I mean, when I was a kid, right, you know, Top Gun was like, everybody watched Top Gun. I mean, mm-hmm. Tom Cruise, I mean, all this stuff. But it was in the theater for like all summer, like all summer, nonstop.
Well, there was no streaming options then. So, right, yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, Roger Ebert said it best. You know, the problem with today's theaters is that they don't allow films to stay longer if they don't have enough staying power week after week. So A Fish Called Wanda, for example, a little trivia I know, is the longest, took the longest to reach number one. But it was also in the theaters for a very long time because of, you know, it became kind of a little bit of a steamrolling effect in terms of people getting interested in the film. But the theater industry and the distributors don't look at it this way. They're not making a lot of money constantly, the films aren't there as long. Because of lack of content, some of these smaller films that you may not be, you know, first glance watch because you're out of watch, like, you know, the big name film you've been waiting for like a year to come out, the smaller film that's out there that doesn't have the same advertising power, you know, maybe an opportunity to catch that because its content is in the theater a little longer because of lack of content. And those smaller films, you know, will gain some steam and suddenly you realize perhaps you're watching an Oscar-nominated film. So in the theater industry is, you know, having a rough time, you know, trying to figure out how to attract customers with limited content and how long to keep content on that, you know, will make the money because, you know, you're all seeing that, you know, hey, they're showing you movies from like 25 years ago, right?
Right.
But I mean, that's part of my fun time. I turn off the phone, you can't find me. And, you know, relax, recline, and just, you know, enjoy the show.
I know one thing you're not doing is taking a boat trip.
Yeah, I'm not a boat guy. I've got a whole lot of coastline, and I really don't like being in the water. I've been known to wade in the water, but that's the extent of my water interest. I've vacationed on beaches in Hawaii and Thailand and, you know, a few places, and I never really, like, I enjoy looking at it, but, you know, I'll get in the water deep enough to watch, like, you know, colorful fish, but I won't be swimming.
Fair enough. Let's see, phone number, email time, Techie.
Sure, 617-722-2370, 617-722-2370 is the office number. We are skeleton staff, as I described in the past. I don't want everybody getting COVID all at once because of the, I don't know, you're sick. I mean, this is, I don't really have to explain this anymore. It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, COVID or anything else, just stay out.
Stay out. So people are, but people are staffed in the office, and we continue to receive your email at tacky.chan@mahost.gov. As always, I prioritize folks with constituent service needs versus the folks that are just promoting or asking me to support or oppose various legislation. You'd be surprised how many people in Quincy actually do not agree on policy. A lot of people don't agree on policy in Quincy, but I do see MBJ emails, and we do log them into our constituent database. We know your positions on different things. You know, obviously, you know, State Representative Tacky Chan Facebook. You can look at my past public hearings as a chair and like this show, saying stuff. God knows what I say. But I mean, you know, we also put out useful information. For example, we should be posting hopefully soon. I have to check with staff, but, you know, the Highland Street Foundation. And I'll repeat this later. I'll send you the chart. You know, we'll have one day free for one venue around the state, so families can go to a arts and cultural thing for their kids and families at a location that, you know, is free. Like I think the Stoneham Zoo has like free admission for a day, for example.
Okay.
And obviously, use the Thomas Crane Library. Call our library. You know, they always have with discounted tickets. to various, you know, art, culture, and other entertainment venues that you get to get advantage this summer if you're looking to do more of a staycation. So you know, that's, I'll be posted in, you know, other phone numbers and other places I've been. You can see me smiling as for like 5 seconds with no mask before I put my mask back on. Zip that off, zip that on situation. And of course, tackykitchen.org. You know, I do get some Squarespace-driven mails from there from folks, as well as, you know, basically looking at some phone numbers that could be helpful to you. So, you know, plenty of ways to find stuff without calling me. We try to do that to see, make it easy as possible. And the flip side, you know, do give us a ring or an email. I do look at it all. And as you may guess, that right now I'm getting a lot of climate change conference community emails and massive droves. We should, if we do this next year, we really got to pick a high season day, and I can read you exactly how many emails I got between the start and end of the show. We should pick
might be kind of fun. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, we could just start to count of how many come in an hour during the time period. But when we get to a higher season, they come in much more heavily. But as we come to the close, it's interesting to see how, you know, how hard these things are coming in and where they're coming from. So I would tell you, I get, well, actually it's not fair because right now in the climate committee conference, so, you know, probably like 2/3 of it is climate conference committee related stuff, of which majority are not constituents. But I do look at those too.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Always a pleasure, Tacky. Appreciate your time.
Oh, very much so, Joe. We'll see you in another week.